Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today it's not really an Echo Chamber Podcast. It's a bit of a crossover with my colleague from the Police Podcast, Vicky Conway. Vicky, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, Tony.
Thanks for doing this. We had a huge reaction to our podcast, our Sunday special this week. With we've been doing them every week, guys. This is the plug. If you want to come along to them, join us on patreon.com/tortoiseshack. You get to come and interact. You don't know who's going to be there. It's part of the buzz is actually we cover the stories of the week, and we also then have a bit of Q&A and we open up the floor. They work in really well, but we had a huge reaction nonetheless. To our first guest on Sunday was Noel Brown, who was an actor, writer, director, facilitator, and just an all-around good person. Noel, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Listen, I just referenced it that you came on, you only 5 or 6 minutes on Sunday, and the reaction was stark. I saw even Simon Magar wrote nearly an entire piece about his reaction to it, which was telling. Do you want to just, first of all, for listeners who missed that, give them an idea of your own background and your story, if that's okay with you?
Sure, yeah. Well, basically, I'm someone who was adopted in the mid-60s from Bellsborough Mother and Baby Home, which is kind of up there with Tuam in terms of the awful behaviour that went on in there. And there's also a mass grave there. It had a higher infant mortality rate than even Tuam, actually. So I was born in Bellsborough and adopted from there. And I grew up being adopted, obviously. I was told I was adopted very early on, but I had no interest throughout my life of tracing, looking for birth family or anything like that. And then in 2002, just a random conversation with a director friend of mine who said that a friend of his had found birth information by contacting Barnardo's. And I just went home and made the first call. And I was naive at the time. You know, I've been thinking about this over the last few days. I thought as an Irish citizen, I just had the right to know where I came from, which everybody else takes for granted. And tribe is so important in this country. So I made the call and they gave me a number to ring in the Southern Health Board in Cork. I was ringing for months. Nobody was getting back to me, leaving a number on an answering machine. Eventually, I kept ringing and got a nun one day who was less than helpful, to say the least, and said I couldn't have any birth information. I wasn't entitled to it. So that shut that conversation down. I was very upset about it. I just didn't understand her behaviour. She was rude, cold, horrible. So I stopped for a couple of months, and then it started to niggle at me going, you know, I must have some rights around here. I'm an Irish citizen. You know, I didn't, you know, I'm an accident of birth. I didn't choose to be born in a mother and baby home. So I rang Barnardo's and they were extremely helpful. They rang the nun, and then I got a grovelly call from the nun 2 days later saying, of course, you can have information. Well, you know, and what I was looking for was basic information. I didn't want an entire history. I just wanted little bits of information. But she had a knee jerk reaction and contacted my birth family and my birth aunt and everything else. So I got a massive amount of information when I did go into Barnardo's. So that was the start of realizing that, OK, this is not an easy process. So I got some of the information about my birth family on my mother's side. Sadly, she had passed away in 9 years previously. She'd been given contaminated blood in the early 90s and died at 47 years of age. So then I met birth family. It was hard because she wasn't around and that was the person I wanted to meet. But her family were absolutely lovely. In 2013, then I wrote a theatre play about my story, because it was the fashion then in contemporary theatre to talk about, you know, yourself on stage. Though I set out to write something else, I ended up with my friend Michelle Forbes writing a play about it. And I suppose that was the start of my activism around it, though I didn't know it at the time. It was the reaction from the audience and from my peers in theatre who went, my God, this is a story we haven't heard. We didn't know that you're not entitled to your birth cert. You're not entitled to birth information without a lot of struggle and a lot of pushing. So then I parked it for a bit. And then in 2017, I began to question, was I the subject of vaccine trials while I was in Bellsborough? And that wouldn't leave me. I also really wanted medical information. You know, I was getting older. The first question someone asks you when you go to a doctor is any family history of? And I was tired of saying, I don't know. I don't have any medical history. So that in 2017, I was being messed around by TUSLA, getting lots of no's. And then I met the Commission of Investigation, which I spoke about on the last podcast. And the reaction from TUSLA was, you know, less than helpful. But at the time, in 2002, I was told by on my information that there was no record of my birth father's name and address. That was deliberately done by a nun who shall remain nameless, but everybody knows who she is if you have anything to do with Besborough. So I assumed there was no information. In 2017, I did a 13-minute interview on the Late Late Show, and 3 days later, I got a call from TUSLA to say, we actually do have your birth father's name and address. So I was stunned, and I said, can I have it? And she'd said, no, you can't. Oh, we'll now put you on a 2.5-year waiting list, and then we will write to him on your behalf. So that was a real shock. And I felt that lie had traveled with me, all of those things. So the 2.5 years were going by, and I had no faith in TUSLA that they would actually do it. So at the end of last year, in 2019, from 2002 to 2019, I went down the DNA route, paid the princely sum of €99 to see if I could find any details about my birth father. It's not a nice experience to pay for information that complete strangers have on a piece of paper. And I found my birth father's family and also discovered that he had died in 2016. Oh, so God. I missed him in that time. During 2017 as well, I did get my file from TUSLA after much begging and pushing. I got some of my file. I didn't get everything because it's quite obvious from the page numbers. But everything with a third party name on it had been redacted. Tipexed out. Everything was gone. So my journey is literally in terms of tracing, you know, to find out where I came from has taken me nearly 20 years of my life. And I find it very hard to deal with in a country where it is something that everybody else takes for granted. I finally got my birth cert. As an adopted person, you're given a short form birth cert, which says you were born in County Dublin. If you were born in Cork, everybody was born in County Dublin, apparently.
There's some pluses to this. Sorry.
Exactly. So I eventually got my original birth cert. I asked, because I traced my birth family, I asked the adoption board, could I have it? And they said no. So I went in shaking, used my birth name and got it myself. There's no father's name on it. There was nothing on it. But I have spent my life investigating my own life and being pushed back by the state, by the system, by the Catholic Church, by TUSLA. And I'm not alone in that. There are 100,000 of us being treated absolutely appallingly. The very thing that the Irish census, if you look at that, people don't know this. There was no way for my adoptive mother, my mum, to put my name down as a child that she reared. It says, how many children did you give birth to? It never says how many children you adopted. Wow. And she was deeply upset by that on the last census. And as far as I'm aware, the next census will say the same thing. There is like a calculated effort to obliterate our births. We are supposed to say our lives started the day we were adopted. Anything before that doesn't matter. When you were born, how you were born, the circumstances, your birth family are significant in everybody's life. Who do you look like? All of those things that everyone else takes for granted. And I'm so angry and hurt, particularly by the piece of legislation that is being fast-tracked through the Dáil. As somebody who met with the Mother and Babies Commission of Investigation, which seems to be just lip service, I think, and I spoke about it on the podcast the other day. So I don't know. I want to move on with my life. I don't want to. I love being with you guys here, but I don't want to spend the rest of my life talking about this. But every couple of years, every couple of months, there's something that they are trying to disappear us. You know, they've done that with the mass graves across Ireland. You know what I mean? And there are infants and babies in mass graves and nobody cares. There's no criminal investigation. Nothing is done. As you can see, it's something I'm very passionate about, but it's coming from, and I am telling my story, as I said, to affect change. And I've been telling it since 2013 publicly. And that's why I'm doing it. And that's why all survivors speak out. But it costs you. It's very difficult to talk about that story. It's very painful. It's very emotional. But as an activist, I feel it's all I can do right now. So
that point that you say about, you know, how much we value identity in this country is really striking to me. I mean, I grew up in Cork and I actually got to the point of annoyance with, like, I wouldn't walk into a room and, oh, you're Rory's daughter, you're Dermot's sister or whatever. And like that, and I'm now suddenly like, wow, like, yeah. We do invest so much in that in our society and who you are and making those connections and everything. So, and obviously you would have had that with your adoptive family, but it's different. Can I ask, at what point, like, did you know at the outset you had been born in Bessborough, and at what point did that start to take on significance for, you know, because we, general society, maybe only learned later on what that really meant. When did you have any understanding of what that meant?
My adoptive parents, my mum and dad, were very unusual in the fact that they told me, you know, when I was born in 1965, but they told me I was adopted from the get-go. That was not the norm. Most people would be told when they were 21, or not at all. The level of secrecy and shame around it, and it was still there. The word illegitimate was still thrown around when I was growing up. So I always knew I was adopted. I suppose, like most adopted people, it hit me in my teenage years, because you're struggling with your identity then. That's when it happens, you know. So that was when it landed with me, going, oh, I don't look like anybody else here. You know, it hit me again when my brother had my two nephews. The first question is, who do they look like? You know what I mean? I never had that. Family funerals was a big thing. I remember, and I documented it in the play, the first time I went to a family funeral and watching that walk down the church. And I could see noses and foreheads and similarities, generations of the same faces going by. And that's when I think it really hit me. And I went home and I took out photographs of the family and went, I don't look like anybody in this family. And that's something people take for granted. And it's something I hope the people who are pushing this legislation through think about, particularly in this time of lockdown, that they go home and they look at their family and they look at the family photographs. And think about the situation 100,000 of us are in Ireland. We don't have that. We take nothing for granted. We can't. So I think that's when it hit me. You know what I mean? That place in family, questioning your identity, who you know what I mean? When I finally met birth family, they said, you have your mother's hands. And, you know, and I certainly have her feet. I have terrible feet. So that was my genetic legacy. But they said, you have her hands. You have the way of her. Which is such an Irish phrase, but it really hit me. And I don't know what that means, because I never met the woman. But those fundamental, basic things that say, who are your people? There's an Irish phrase for it. I don't know what it is, but it's rooted in who you are. And it's so important. We care about tribe in this country. Mm-hmm. Who do you look like? You're so-and-so's daughter, or you're so-and-so. And it's a very strange. There are positives to it. You develop a different sense of self, because it starts and ends with you. You don't have anything to look at, any mirrors. So I was lucky in that sense. But I grew up in a time where, you know, bad blood will out was said to me, not by my family, but in wider society. Your birth mother screwed up. You will. You have this legacy. You're lucky to be adopted.
It's in the kitten. All of these awful phrases that have been used. And I'm struck by the word you said at the time. You said that at the time people were comfortable saying, you know, illegitimate.
Yep.
I put it to you now that we are still legitimizing
absolutely,
and what's been carried on now is just sanitized. It's been done in such a way as we can do it respectfully with a 4,000 page report that then puts everything away. Knowing, I haven't heard you, like, you've explained it so eloquently, so anything I say is gonna fluff it, but that sense of tribe, that sense of identity, how do we balance that right with also some of the rights of privacy? Because, you know, this concern that I'm using the air quotes for people who are listening, around the right to be forgotten or the right of privacy. How do we balance that in your mind to the right that you have, the absolute right to know your medical history, your identity, your very essence of who you are and where you came from?
Absolutely. I don't use the word privacy. I use the word secrecy, because I think privacy has been misused. But yes, there is an issue around that. But there's also the fact that this is a private family matter. There are no other families that would be interfered with in this way. I mean, the only thing I can liken it to is if one of you had a family member that you became estranged from and they disappeared, but you knew they were out there somewhere. And the only way you could contact them was through the state. So you contact the state and you say, look, I just want someone to know that, you know, if they want to contact me, they can, or I just want them to know that I'm okay. Can you just let them know, or could you give me their contact details? I just want to give that contact. They are family. And the state says, no, you can't. Or they give you the wrong information, or they lie, or they ignore you, or they put a piece of legislation in place that says, no, you cannot act in this way, even though it is a private family matter. That's the only thing I can say. Also, we have been demonized as adopted people. I heard a politician recently use the phrase, you know, oh, I have a friend who, you know, put a child up for adoption and she's waiting for the knock on the door. Like, that's a disgusting way to talk about an adopted person. We are aware. It is with great difficulty that we go searching. We are aware. We are emotionally aware of what the implications are. But there's a demonizing of us. There's an infantilizing of us that we are not allowed to be in charge of our lives. You know, it's not about, you know, knocking on the door. Sometimes it's just about having the information. It's about knowing that we have a choice. Our choice has been taken away, the choice whether to contact a birth family or not, or for them to contact us. Because both situations that I have had in terms of birth family, they're extremely angry with the way I was treated. And they are secure in the knowledge that I would have been accepted. I would have been met. It would have been fine. But that choice was taken away until it was too late. You know what I mean? Until my, particularly in case of my birth father, who was dead. That choice is taken from me. He wasn't given a choice and I wasn't given a choice in a private family matter.
And we should remember that a lot of the women who had these children weren't given a choice either.
Absolutely. They were forced adoptions.
You know, yeah. I wanted to ask you about the vaccinations and if you can talk a bit more about that, because you've mentioned it, but I'm actually getting goose pimples thinking about it. Like, so they tested vaccinations on the babies in
without the mother's consent. Yes. And this is fact. You know, Conall O'Farrell has written extensively about it. He went through, he found the evidence. You know, it is there. I think it was GlaxoSmithKline was one of the people that was involved. They did food supplement trials as well. And there's descriptions of babies, you know, having diarrhea, vomiting, infants. This is what they did. And I became aware of the vaccine trials when I went to the Bellsborough Commemoration Service and I met with two men who had scars on their bodies from those vaccines. So with that started me thinking, going, they took these babies without the mother's consent and put vaccine trials on them. And this is all true. That's the thing. People don't know about it, but it's out there. It's fact. There was follow up then. They would come to the house and they would keep, the doctor or nurse would keep injecting. These were lay people who were doing this. I mean, it's horrific. It's you know what I mean? It's Nazi Germany. It's like, what's between the mass graves and the vaccine trials? But I was horrified when I heard about it. And it started me wondering, because when I came out, when I was adopted from Bellsborough, I had a convulsion that nobody could explain, which I was told at the time. I was very lucky that a doctor and that my mother did the right thing. I was saved, but I could have ended up with severely brain damaged or I was going to die. Nobody could explain why that happened. And I've spoken to doctors since, and they wondered, was it anything to do with the vaccine trial? So that's why I went looking, you know, and the fact that I was so horrified that could happen in an institution. And they are institutions. They can't really call them homes, but it's gone on and to a scale that is horrific, absolutely horrific.
It reminds me a lot when you keep using these phrases. You talk about being delegitimized, being othered in effect, and being less than, dehumanized. And I, you know, one of the words, I think I'm right in saying that in the caste system, the Dalits were considered unclean. And there's definitely that experience of the mothers who were taken and forced into adoptions, and they were considered unclean.
And that's the thing. I mean, I considered myself someone who was born in a mother and baby institution. But the day that the tomb story broke, I became a survivor. And then on top of that, with Bellsborough, another mass grave with only 64 babies accounted for. There are 900 babies in Bellsborough. That I went, oh, my God, I could have not made it out of there, you know. And that's a horrible concept. And the babies that didn't, and the children and their mothers searching for 30, 40, 50 years, 60 years looking for them. It's horrific. And that's our history. And what we're doing today in the Dáil is we're going to push through a piece of legislation that will seal all those testimonies, all that information. It's like, put it away for 30 years. It's still going to be there. I mean, the only thing that I hope and I've discovered this over the last while, is that the younger generation, younger than me, I'm 54 now, care about this deeply. They are the children of mothers who were born in those mother and baby homes who are really angry. And I met a lot of them when I did my play the last time in the Abbey and the Peacock. They came to that and they were so angry. And that's all I can hope for. They're waiting for us to die. It's delay, deny till we die. And they're still operating on that. But I hope that the support we have now, and it has been amazing. We, you know what I mean? 30,000 emails apparently to the Dáil. We've never had that level of support because I think people are care. People understand that this, we are, our human rights are being destroyed. And it's now a time to lift that secrecy and shame and infantilizing of us and denial of human rights. It's time. We need to deal with this. There's no point in burying it all, pushing it away. It's time to deal with it. You know, we have to move on.
Because some of the people listening may not have caught the podcast on Sunday, because you still do not know whether vaccine trials were conducted on you.
No. I mean, it's why I went to the Mother and Baby Homes Commission of Investigation. There were two branches to it. I think I said this the other day, but you didn't know about that it was the confidential committee, which is who you met first, and then the investigation branch. I went and met with the confidential committee.
Like, even that name, confidential committee?
Yeah. I didn't ask for confidentiality, and I said that on the day to them. I don't want this confidential. But I requested that day that I be put forward to the Commission of Investigation to find out if I had been the subject of vaccine trials. Said, "Oh, we'll have to check if you're a fit candidate." So that was in March. By September, I'd still heard nothing, and I wrote to them, and I got a solicitor's letter back going, "Oh, we can't investigate in your behalf because we're investigating." It was all this kind of garbled thing. Go back to Tuzla and see if they can help you, which is what I did, and they were zero help.
What does fit candidate mean?
Exactly. What does that mean? A fit candidate. It's again, the language that we use around adoption, particularly in terms of legislation and in terms of the debates that are out there, is so offensive. It really is. It's just that it's the othering. It's what you were saying. It's the othering of us, like, oh, God, what are we going to do with that? We're just a problem. What are we going to do with it? And it was I was just shocked by it. You know what I mean? I thought, well, then what is this about? And it was a sense during that meeting with them, the confidential committee, that this was just lip service. It was never going to amount to anything, you know. And I'm glad I went. I went because other people didn't feel that they could. It was too much of a difficult thing to do and lots of reasons. But I'm glad I did it. But it was that sense of, and now on top of that, to see that they're going to take those transcripts, testimonies, all of that and seal it away for 30 years. What does that say, you know? And it's not about privacy. It's about secrecy, you know, and keeping us in that little thing. Just bury us, bury the problem, which is what we do in Ireland, unfortunately, you know.
And we haven't. I notice I shouldn't really bring it to the contemporary, bring it forward, because I hate when people say this is historic. It's not historic. No, no. I'm talking to you right now. There you are. You're not. You're alive. And I hate that kind of idea. Well, it's historic clerical sex abuse. It's historic violence against the state, against women and children, which is mainly where we are. And then you see only, like, I don't know if you noticed in the last few hours, a report on direct provision and, you know, pushback from within the state saying, oh, that might go too far, you know, let's not. And you're going, oh, we're still at it, and we're still
it's what we do. But it is right bang in the present. And I think we go, oh, the history of the mother and baby homes, the history of the industrial schools, all of those things, you go, no, we're still dealing with it. Mm. We're still dealing with the effects of it and still being treated the same. And that was the wake up call for me when I started the process of tracing. It was like, I'm still being spoken to like I am that illegitimate child sitting there. You know what I mean? That it was just, nothing has changed.
I think there's this narrative in Ireland that, look, in the 50s and 60s, sure, weren't we doing our best, economically poor, new state, and the church was, you know, doing its best, and it was all well-intentioned. But you just look back, and the amount of harm our state has done to ourselves. I mean, the mother and baby homes, Magdalene Laundry, synphysiotomy, clerical abuse, like, we can go on and on. I was very honoured. Maeve O'Rourke invited me to participate in the Dublin Honours Magdalene event. And, like, I sat at a table with 10 women that had been in the Magdalene Laundries. And I left that day bereft of humanity. Like it, I felt this is close to, and you've mentioned Nazi Germany. I mean, you know, these women had shaves, they didn't have names, they were numbers, they were abused, everything. And we have to confront that.
Yeah, we do.
We have to acknowledge that this was done in our name, in the Irish state's name. And we have to say sorry and give you everything you want to know.
It's too easy to blame the church entirely. And that's what I think. It's like the state responsibility.
Yeah.
Think about the babies. And there were hundreds of them shipped to America. I was nearly one of them, actually. Apparently, I missed it by about a year, according to my adoptive mum. There was talk of that. And also, I think they couldn't send me because I had big, bright red hair. I would have been quite obviously come from somewhere else. But, you know, those babies traveled. They needed passports. They didn't come from the Catholic Church. They came from the state. Yeah. It was church and state. We were a problem. They gave it to the church. The church made a business out of it. Like literally, the fact that, I mean, I only realized this recently, those babies that are in mass graves are there because the nuns were paid to bury them. And if they didn't pay for the burial, they got to keep the money. So they just threw them all in a pit, basically. I mean, that is just, but the money was coming from the state. So it's church and state.
Yeah.
I remember a politician actually saying to me when I was deep in the activism 2017, she said, don't underestimate the seam of Catholicism in Irish politics. Mm-hmm. And that was a real wake up call for me. I thought, oh God, I thought we were over all that. But no, it's still there. We will protect the church at all costs. And that's terrifying in 2020. And people like us, like the adoption community, survivors, birth mothers, we are the ones that are taking the brunt of that. And it's, I can't believe that Ireland is, that this is happening in Ireland right now, particularly because we've had repeal and marriage equality and, you know, we're slightly cool now in the world. But this one thing, we just won't deal with it.
We don't want to look at it. And that's clear. That's clear. When you saw the scenes yesterday in the Dáil where it was put to the Taoiseach and he dying to lecture people back saying, no, this is not what that's about at all. And, you know, it's, they've learned almost four or five lines. I mean, I've seen people, I've seen county councillors lecture Maeve O'Rourke on human rights. And I'm thinking, what world am I living in when they think that they can lecture Maeve O'Rourke on how to, what people's human rights are. So there is this, I'm going to say small C conservatism. I like your expression, the seam of Catholicism as well. It runs throughout it. The last thing to me, obviously for me now, is this has been, as you said, nearly 20 years you've been campaigning for this now. You've also given, I think, a bit of hope in the next generation, because unfortunately trauma can be intergenerational. And we've seen that. Is there reason for hope? Do we think we can push this across and actually win?
I don't know. I'm reliably informed. I actually, you know, I'm so deep in doing these interviews and keeping going with that, that's what I can do as an activist. I'm not sure we're going to do okay on this, to be quite honest. That seems to be the consensus. I hope that I'm proved wrong, but I hope that if that is the case, and I really don't want that to happen, I hope that out of that will come something else that will open doors that we didn't expect, that we will win in another way. That's all I hope for, because it's time. You know, it can't just end here. We've been fighting for a long time. And thank you for saying that I've been an activist from, you know, for 20 years. I haven't. I started in 2013. It's people like Claire McKettrick and Susan Lohan in the Adoption Rights Alliance. Those people have been fighting since 2002. They are absolute, like, I'm on giant shoulders. They're extraordinary women and they haven't given up. But I think something has happened in terms of the support now, that the 30,000 emails that crashed the server in the Dáil, we've never had that. It started a little bit on the last piece of legislation that Catherine Zappone was trying to push through, the deeply discriminatory piece of legislation, the Adoption Information and Tracing Bill. We started to get support. You know, there was a couple of thousand emails, and 30,000 emails is fantastic. We cannot do it without people's support. And whatever the next chapter is in terms of our rights and being acknowledged and dealing with the mass graves and giving those relatives and families peace of mind and the respect that they deserve, I think we have support, and I want people to stay with us. And that's why I'm here talking about it, because people need to know how bad this is.
Yeah, I'm struck. You mentioned Claire McKettrick. I mean, people like her just working so long. And even you say only 2013. I mean, God, that's 7 years.
Yeah.
7 years. But just for listeners, you know, there is nothing more effective than an email to a TD, you know. them being floored with those, that tells them this is what my constituents want, and so they're going to do it. So a one line, I object to this bill.
Yeah.
That's it, to your TDs today.
And if they come banging on your door, you know, if there's another election or anything else, raise that issue, because it just needs to be out there. It needs to be talked about in the way that repeal was, and marriage equality, really importantly. But absolutely contact them. And something else, actually, in terms of the emails that I've been sending ferociously, the tone of the TDs and senators, particularly coming back to me, is so heartfelt and so supportive. That wasn't there either. You'd get your acknowledgement. Oh, thank you for your email. They are so on our side, so many of them now, and understand the level of, pain that is being inflicted on survivors with this legislation. And that's heartening as well. So we have to take the positives out of it. But anyone out there, please contact your TDs. If it's too late to do an email, pick up the phone, write to them, drop a letter through the door, whatever you can do, because we do need your help, you know.
And I think people think this is like, it's so far away, I can't imagine it. But actually we can, like, step into those shoes of not knowing your parents' medical history. Step into those shoes of your child having vaccine trials done on them without your consent and not being told about it. Everyone can come close in some way to imagining the really human need for this to be handled differently.
The image that haunts me about my birth mother, to get a sense of what went on when she was in the home, I never got to meet her, is the fact that when she was heavily pregnant with me, she was made to scrub floors. That image will haunt me. And everybody who's adopted has some image or some story or memory that they've been told that lives with them. A heavily pregnant woman on her knees scrubbing a floor. That's what we're up against. And that's what, we're left with those memories. We're left with those thoughts that we have to carry with us because a woman got pregnant. A woman got pregnant.
She committed the crime.
She committed a crime. You know, the what do they call them? The penitence, or, you know, they used to use that phrase. But that's the image that haunts me. And I've written about it because it's just desperate. I mean, why would you inflict that on anyone, you know? And now, as her child, all these traumas are keep being inflicted on me by a denial of my rights. I'm 54 years of age. I shouldn't have to deal with this, you know.
Noelle Brown, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us again. I hope listeners do react. I hope they do pick up their phones. They get on their tweets. They get on and they email. Nothing. I know we're in a pandemic. It makes it a lot harder to doorstep people, but make sure they know that you object to this. And fingers crossed, the next time we maybe talk to you, we're talking about something different, and, you know, something in the arts and something like that would be wonderful. It'd be terrific. Thank you so much again for your time.
Thank you.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony.